sahanavavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, sahavidyan karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu mavidvishavahai. Om shanti, shanti, shanti. Om. Very good. Welcome back. We'll continue our study of chapter 13. We'll begin with some recitation. Turn this up just a tiny bit. We'll begin our recitation with verse 7. Repeat after me, please.
Amanitvamadam hitvam, hamanitvamadam, ahimsakshantirarjavam, ahimsakshantirarjavam, acharyopasanam shaucham, acharyopasanam, sthairyam atma vinigraha, indriyarteshu vairagyam, indriyarteshu, anahankara hevacha, anahankara, janma mrityuchara vyadhi, janma mrityuchara, dukkha doshanu darshanam, dukkha doshanu, asaktiranabhishvangaha, asaktiranabhishvang, putradara grahadishu, putradara, nityancha samachittattvam, nityancha samach, ishtanishtopapattishu, ishtanishtopapattishu, mai chananya yogena, mai chananya bhaktiravya vicharini, bhaktiravya vicharini, vivikta desha sevitvam, vivikta desha Haratir jana samsadi, haratir jana adhyatma jnana nityatvam, adhyatma jnana tattva jnanartha darshanam, tattva jnanartha etad jnanam iti proktam, etad jnanam ajnanam hyaratonyata, ajnanam hyarat Nyeyam yattat pravakshyami, nyeyam yattat pravakshyami, yajñātvāmṛtam aśnute, yajñātvāmṛtam, anārimatparam brahma, anārimatparam, nasattannāsaduchyate, nasattannās, sarvatah pāṇipādam tat, sarvatah pāṇipādam, sarvatokshishiro mukham, sarvatokshishiro, sarvatashrutimalloke, sarvatashrutimal, sarvamavrityatishtati, sarvamavritya, sarvendriyaguna bhasam, sarvendriyaguna, sarvendriyavivarjitam, sarvendriyavivarjitam, Saktam sarva bhrityaiva, asaktam sarva nirgunam guna boktracha, nirgunam guna bahirantascha bhutanam, bahirantascha acharam charam evacha, acharam charam sukshmatvatara vigneyam, sukshmatvatara vigneyam durastam chanti ke chatat, durastam chanti ke avibhaktam cha bhuteshu, avibhaktam cha vibhaktam iva cha sthitam, vibhaktam iva cha bhuta bhartra cha tadnyayam, bhuta bhartra cha tadnyay grasishnu prabha vishnu cha, grasishnu prabha vishnu cha. Very good. So, back to verse 7. There we are. And just to pick up the thread and introduce where we are before we proceed. This chapter, as you remember, three pairs of question, kshetra and kshetrajna, finished.
Jnanam and Jnayam is what we're studying. Later will come Purusha and Prakriti. We'll see that later. So Jnanam and Jnayam. Jnayam is that which is to be known. What is to be known? Brahman. And we'll see that's coming after several more verses. How will we get that knowledge? That is the most lofty of all kinds of knowledge. Without proper preparation, it is utterly impossible to get the knowledge. We spent part of the last class talking about adhikaritvam, preparedness, readiness to use a pramana, a means of knowledge. We gave the example many times of prerequisites for college class, just as there are certain prerequisites for college class in order for the material of that class to be accessible to you. In the same way, for these teachings of Vedanta, including the teachings of Sri Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, there are certain prerequisites. What are some of the prerequisites are pretty obvious. If you need to read what's on the screen, you need eyes. If you need to hear what the guru is saying, you need ears, etc. But now we're in the midst of discussing some other prerequisites. These prerequisites are collectively called jnanam. Jnanam literally means knowledge, but in this context, jnanam refers to the prerequisites for gaining this Vedantic wisdom, knowledge of Brahman, knowledge of the Absolute Reality. And here, in a series of five verses, which we've just begun, in a series of five verses, Sri Krishna gives a list of 20 values or qualities or virtues, attributes of a person, which are essential attributes for the sake of being prepared. It would be a little bit like in your college catalog. Suppose they listed 20 prerequisite courses for the course you wanted to take. Well, that's the equivalent here. For the sake of Brahmavid, you say 20, my God. Well, hey, you're talking about a course, you know, whatever it is, Geography 401. There's no such thing. I'm just making this up. So for the sake of taking your Geography 401 course, there may be, you know, Geography 201 is a prerequisite. Remember all this stuff? Okay. But here, imagine looking in that catalog and seeing for such and such a course, there are no fewer than 20 prerequisites. You might be dissuaded from taking such a course. Oh, well, this is too much for me. Well, bear in mind, what kind of knowledge are we seeking here? This is not Geography 401. This is Brahmavidya. So for Brahmavidya, what should be the prerequisites for gaining this wisdom? Now you're on board. You get the point. So we see this series of 20 qualifications, and it begins in verse 7 and goes on for a series of five verses. Let's recite verse 7 and then we'll pick up the thread. Amanitvam adambhitvam, amanitvam adham, ahimsa chantir arjavam, ahimsa chantir acharyopasanam shaucham, acharyopasthairyam hin. Stairam atma vinigraha, stairam atma vinigraha. Good. And we saw the first part of this verse. In the last class we saw already, amanitvam, absence of mana, absence of pride, adambhitvam, absence of pretension, no pretentiousness. And I'm not going to, we've discussed these already, so I'm just going to mention them in passing. Ahimsa, not causing harm to anyone or anything. Kshantihi, patience, forbearance, arjavam, straightforwardness, alignment of thought, word, and deed. And the last one we saw was acharya, upasanam, some form of service to the teacher for the sake of making the teachings available. So this much we've seen in our list of 20. These are some of the requirements. Now they don't look so intimidating, right? If you saw 20 prerequisites for a college course, that might be intimidating. These 20 don't look that intimidating, do they? Amanitvam, adambitvam? No. These are values that we can and must cultivate. These are values that every one of us have to some measure. But then again, what are we seeking? Brahma Vidya. So for the sake of Brahma Vidya, having these qualities to a minor degree is not going to be adequate. We need to embody these qualifications to a complete degree. You already are relatively free of mana, pride. Okay, we have to cultivate that some more. You're already quite free of pretentiousness. Well, cultivate it a little bit more. You already don't cause injury to others regularly. Okay, cultivate it a little bit more. You get the idea. So already you have these qualities. We're talking about cultivating them to an adequate degree so that you can gain Brahma Vidya. Okay, let's pick up the thread. We left off on Shaucham, literally purity. And purity, of course, we're not merely talking about external purity. I mean, the obvious part is we bathe, we take care of our bodies, etc. By the way, Shaucham would include keeping your home clean. And to embarrass a few of you, Shaucham could be extended to keeping your desk orderly. Uh-oh. Maybe some work is needed there. Okay, me too. All right. So, and why? Why would we extend it to keeping your house clean and your desk orderly? Have you noticed how the environment in which we are, in our environments affect us? When you're in a very crowded, noisy, cluttered environment, does that affect you? And when you're in a very simple, clean, quiet environment, how that affects you? Well, in your home, you have some control over that, do you not? Exactly. There's some places you have little control. When you go to work, when you're in a certain places, there's little control. When you go to a market, etc. But in your home, you have some control. So that's where we can exercise some diligence and care to make your home environment, including your desk, to make it a suitable environment for living a life of spiritual growth. That's really the context. So this is Bahir Shaucham, Bahir Shaucham, external purity. And we want to talk about the internal purity, which is much more important. What do we mean by internal purity? Well, we have to understand what are the impurities. What are the impurities that should be avoided or removed? Things like sadness, anger, irritation, frustration, jealousy. Oh, this is a big deal. This inner purity means being free from jealousy, anger, frustration, etc., etc., etc. And to become free of that is no small matter. There's a twofold approach. One is whatever impurities have gone in, you need to handle those. How do you handle those? Prayer, meditation, all of our practices. If there's some emotional problems require an emotional solution. So if there's a problem with a particular person, the solution might involve talking to that person. So the solution has to be appropriate to the nature of the problem. Don't think that you can just sit and meditate and make all of this stuff go away. Meditation is not the solution to all those problems. Remember, I told this anecdote long ago. Some of you remember this. I was when I was a student at Arsha Vidya in the 1980s. We were living there together, a group of us, 60 students. And for whatever reason, another student and I got into a big argument. It happens. And we both got angry. We both got frustrated. We both got hurt, etc., etc. Then we went our ways. And I held all of this anger and hurt inside of me, and it felt terrible. That is a good example of the inner impurity. What to do to get rid of the impurity? Well, in those days, even now, I'm meditation. But now, this is a counterexample. Watch where this goes. Don't draw any conclusion yet. So I felt so terrible. I wanted to get rid of all these this feeling of anger and hurt. So I sat to meditate. And because the feeling of anger and hurt was so intense, after 1 hour of meditation, I still felt crummy. So I went on meditating more. After 2 hours of meditation, I still felt bad. After 2.5 hours, honestly, after 2.5 hours of meditation, I finally felt relieved. All of that, all of the anger and hurt had finally dissipated. I felt a sense of lightness in my chest, and I felt free. I felt really good. I got up from my room. I went out. A few minutes later, I saw that fellow again, and in a moment, all of the bad feelings returned. 2.5 hours of meditation down the drain. I'm telling this anecdote. Some of you have heard it before, but I'm telling it because it illustrates something very important. When there is a problem, you have to apply the correct solution. And meditation is not a solution for some emotional problems like that. So I needed to go and talk to the person and reconcile with the person. And I failed to do that. I failed to go for the right solution. So with regard to all of these internal impurities, you have to use an appropriate solution. The impurities we're talking about, for the most part, are emotional in nature. So therefore, the solutions have to acknowledge the reality of our emotions. We have to deal with them at their own level. Meditation, in a sense, is an attempt to up-level the problem. It's like to ignore the problem or to imagine the problem isn't. Anyway, and for many reasons, meditation is not an appropriate solution. This is with regard to impurities that are already within you. The better strategy, of course, for maintaining the shaucham, this inner purity, the best strategy is not to let the impurities get in there in the first place, right? Good. So, and a careful, diligent, awareful life, being mindful in the moment and not causing problems, not allowing these kinds of problems to develop, in my case, it would have been not allowing the discussion to turn into an argument with that person. I could have and should have been more alert and more diligent to prevent that argument from arising in the first place. So that's also an important part of the shaucham. Shaucham then referring the external stuff we talked about. Now with regard to the internal impurities, a matter of not letting new impurities come in and dealing with whatever impurities are already there. It's really important to recognize that these impurities we're talking about are emotional in nature. Just one more comment on this, because it's something we often overlook. We sometimes think that our life of spiritual pursuit, our study of the Bhagavad Gita, our practice of meditation and our prayer, etc., we sometimes think or conclude that this spiritual practice is powerful enough to take care of all of our emotional problems. In American English, we call them emotional hang-ups. You've heard that expression? So all these emotional hang-ups, or they use the term baggage. Good terms. All this emotional baggage. So we've come to believe that a life of spiritual practice should be powerful enough to deal with all this emotional baggage. It's not true. My meditation story suggests that it's not true, and I'm going to tell you a more important story, and some of you have heard this from me long ago, about Pujya Swami Dayananda, my guru, who came to this country in the 1970s, and when he started teaching in this country, he taught a 3-year course first in California, then he taught another 3-year course to us, our students in the 1980s in Pennsylvania. And when he came here, he thought that these teachings of Vedanta that he had been teaching for years were so powerful that it could straighten up all of us. Let me be a little silly here. All of us messed up American students. I have a feeling the students he had in India, when you think about students that come to a Vedanta teacher, generally, they're students from a very pious family and students who have had a very good upbringing in a really solid Hindu family. Most of his students in India were like that. When he started here, in fact, his first course was in California in the 1970s. In California, things are a little different. Not that they're so, they're same in New Jersey. For starters, in California and in Pennsylvania, more than 50% of the students come from families in which there's been divorce, right? What is the divorce rate in this country? You know. Which means most of the students came from families that had divorce. And not just divorce, all other problems. You know, it's a stereotype, and all stereotypes are wrong. But there's always a little truth to a stereotype as well, that American students may not have the kind of inner maturity and stability and emotional health that the students in India may have had. That's not an that's not true overall by any means. But, excuse me, I have to say, as one of those American students, it bears some truth that American students have emotional problems and baggage and issues to be dealt with. Indian students also have. I think American students have a little extra. This is my opinion. Of course, nowadays things are changing. This is back in the 1970s and 80s. Anyway, the story, Pooja Swamiji arrives in this country. He's ready to teach. And he believes early on that these teachings of Vedanta are adequate for these young American students to come out of all these emotional problems. And after a year or two of teaching, he discovers it's not working. Honestly. And he admitted that to us in a class. He said, early on, I tried ignoring all these emotional problems. I thought you guys would eventually get out of it and work it out on your own. And then he said, I can see it's not working by merely employing the teachings of Vedanta. And from that time forward, he actually began addressing emotional issues in his Vedanta classes. What an amazing realization. So he started off with this common wrong conclusion that spiritual teachings are adequate, powerful enough to deal with all the emotional problems we might have. And he himself, in his own words, he said, we taught him a lesson. Not a very nice lesson. The lesson was that the teachings of Vedanta, as powerful as they are not adequate to deal with emotional problems. It's not the right, you need the right tool for the job. If you have a nail sticking out, you don't need a screwdriver. If there's a loose screw, you don't need a hammer. It's common sense, and it applies here. Emotional problems require an emotional solution. Clear enough? And the ashaucham, the lack of purity we're talking about, is primarily emotional problems that are unresolved. So those unresolved emotional problems require emotional solutions. And if that solution involves seeing a therapist, good, let it be. Therapists can be very helpful. There's no problem in getting outside help wherever that help may come from. That's a good thing. All right, enough on Shaucham. Sthairyam, stability. Stability means the ability to cope with problems without being flattened by them. It means having some inner strength, having some ability to withstand. It's like the tree outside. The wind blows, and the tree doesn't just fall over. The tree bends and sways and comes back. That's a kind of sthairyam we're meant to have. This metaphor of the tree, which is, by the way, a very ancient metaphor, it's been used by many cultures. It's been used in Chinese culture, Indian culture, American culture. We see this metaphor again and again because it shows that if the tree doesn't bend in the wind, it breaks. Styrian is not rigidity. Let's be very clear. Being rigid is not a value. Being rigid is a problem. And sometimes in Hindu culture, this is misunderstood. No, one of the most common misunderstandings, just to show, is people will point to Bhishma, Pitamaha, in the Mahabharata, and point out how his sthairyam, how strong he was, how committed he was to maintaining his vows. In spite of everything, he maintained his vows. And people will say, what a great example. Whoever says that hasn't really understood the Mahabharata. Because if you understand the Mahabharata, you realize that Bhishma's clinging to his vows is one of the factors that contributed to that horrible war. And he even admits, as he's dying on that bed of arrows, he admits he made a mistake. He shouldn't have been so rigid. That's not strength, that's rigidity. Holding on no matter what, blindly holding on, is not a value. That's rigidity. The tree that's rigid breaks off in the wind. The tree that's supple, the tree that bends in the wind, is a tree that survives. That's the kind of styrian we want. Not rigidity, but the ability to withstand the forces that push on us. Like the tree needs to withstand the force of the wind, we need to withstand the forces that act on us in our lives, the force of losing a job, the force of losing a loved one. We need to bend and deal with those forces that act upon us. That is sthairyam. Next, atma vinigraha. Vinigraha means control. Control of atma. Atma cannot possibly mean Satchidananda, right? You can't control atma. It's silly. So atma has other meanings in Sanskrit. You know, the simplest meaning of atma is simply self, and not with a capital S. It's just used to refer to yourself. So atma can refer to your body. Absolutely. Atma can refer to your mind and personality. Absolutely. And here, that's what it refers to. Atma vinigraha means control of your body and mind. And we're talking about what a mature person does. A lot of these 20 values and virtues are really talking about the nature of a mature person. And one thing that's certainly true of a mature person, they're in control of what they say, of what they do, and to some extent of what's going on inside of their minds. How different from a child? A child who, the youngest of children can't even control their bowels, etc. You know, that's true of us all. But that lack of control shows the lack of maturity. The implication, then, is whenever we fail to control our behavior, when we fail to control what we say and do, that is, when we say or do the wrong thing, we're behaving like children. That's childish. We know better. If we say or do something that's hurtful to somebody else, we know it's going to be hurtful to them. Why do we do that? We know better. We have a value for ahimsa. We talked about in the last class. If you have a value for ahimsa, why then do we sometimes do or say something hurtful to another person? That's the absence of self-control. Atma vinigraha, self-control, means to... it's just... What do we say in American English? Bite your lip. Self-control. You don't have to say it. Now, it's not so easy, because definitely everyone has a limit. That is, we are in control of our behavior up to a certain point. It's like we all have a set point. If somebody is irritating you, I've given this example before. If someone is irritating you, and if the irritation is below your set point, you're okay. You're calm, you're controlled, you're in control. But as soon as the level of irritation crosses your set point, watch out. Look out. Anything can happen. This is human nature. We acknowledge it. What can we do about that set point? And we've discussed this in several contexts. One of the best ways to raise that set point is to meditate. Absolutely. Any form of meditation. Any form of meditation creates a mind. And meditation, by the way, when I say any form of meditation, I mean meditation performed not once a week on a Saturday morning, but meditation performed 7 days a week. And we have to say it what it is. Meditation, daily meditation, is not optional for a spiritual seeker. It's like food is not optional, bathing is not optional, sleep is not optional, etc. Meditation, daily meditation is not optional. And one of the benefits of that daily meditation is wherever your trip point might be, it will get higher and higher and higher with regular meditation. And in that way, things that used to drive you crazy will no longer bother you. Wouldn't that be worth it? That alone is enough to justify the practice of meditation. Think of the things that irritate you in life now. Wouldn't it be nice if it didn't irritate you anymore? It would be wonderful, delightful. How to get there? Raise that trip point. How to raise that trip point? Meditate. When to meditate? Every day. Every day, some convenient time for you. And just 10-15, you don't need to meditate for, I mentioned 2.5 hours before. You can meditate just for 10, 15, 20 minutes. That's all it takes to raise that trip point. 10, 15, 20 minutes of daily meditation will raise that trip point. Now, this is Atma Vinigraha. Let's continue. Indriyarteshu vairagyam indriyarteshu anahankara hevacha anahankara janma mrityu jara vyadhi janma mrityu jara dukkha doshanu darshanam dukkha dosha. So here we have three more of the 20 values or virtues. Start from the second quarter. Anahankaraha evacha. Anahankara, absence of ego. And ego here, not in the very Vedantic sense of self-concept and sense of individuality, but here in a more direct sense. Just ahankara in a sense of, not even a sense of pride, because amanitvam was the first of our values, right? So we won't take ahankara here in exact in a sense of pride. How about in the sense of very nice, very clear American expression, me first. Ahankara means what? Me first. And by the way, isn't, again, stereotypes, here's another stereotype. Again, stereotypes are wrong, but there's an element of truth. One thing that seems certainly much more true of American culture as compared to traditional cultures in India, etc., America is definitely a me first culture. We all want what we want, and we want it now. We don't want to wait for it. That sense of impatience, and that sense of, shall I say, entitlement? I deserve this, and I don't deserve that. That's the sense of ahankara here. That sense of entitlement, that sense of me first, the sense that my agenda is more important than yours. Me first. So that is ahankara. And that is a huge obstacle remember in the prior class when we introduced this, we said that how can we live a spiritual life if we're constantly in a state of conflict with others? We talked about this last week. We just mentioned it briefly here because it certainly is very relevant. If we're constantly in a state of conflict with others, and you know some people who are always struggling and they got a problem with this person, they got a problem with that person, they got a problem with the other person. It's not just mother-in-law, but it's like every other person in their life is out to get them. And they will list all of the reasons why each of those problems are a source of headaches. But tell me, which is more likely that each of those, you know, those 45 people, do you think all of those 45 people really have an agenda against this person, or do you think it's more likely that this person has a problem? 45 versus 1 is the idea. So if 45 people are against me, or is it that I am against 45 people? Which is more likely, right? So this is the sense of the ahankara, someone who has an attitude in which they're unable to accommodate others, an attitude in which their own personal agenda comes first, they feel entitled, and they feel that the world should conform to their personal wishes. How immature. But all of that is suggested by this ahankara, me first, that sense of entitlement. So that's ahankara, means that entitlement, me first. Un-ahankara means the absence then of that me first attitude, the absence of that sense of entitlement is un-ahankara, the value of being freed from that particular kind of egoism, me first-ism, as it were. Then, indriyarteshu vairagyam, which is really connected to janma mrityu jara vyadhi dukkha dosha anudarshanam. By the way, that's one word. In Sanskrit, we have these long compound words, so this is all one word. Janma mrityu jara vyadhi dukkha dosha anudarshanam is one compound word. I'll explain the meaning in just a moment. First of all, indriyarteshu vairagyam. Vairagyam, dispassion. The condition of having viraga, the condition of having dispassion, is vairagyam, dispassion. Dispassion towards what? Indriya arteshu. Dispassion towards artha, objects of the indriyas, of the senses. Dispassion towards sense objects. Dispassion towards sense objects is, and we've used this expression here long ago, the image comes if you go to one of these restaurants that have a buffet. On one of the tables are all of the desserts, and as you're walking past that table, there's this magnetic force that seems to pull you, drag you towards the table. A table full of foods, your physician has very sternly told you, you can't eat this, you can't eat that, you've got to change this and that and the other thing. You know that this food is harmful to you, but you feel this powerful magnetic attraction. Who's stronger, you or this piece of cake? This piece of cake seems to exercise some control over you. Doesn't that sound ridiculous? But isn't that exactly what it is? If a piece of cake has control over you, something is really wrong. Vairagya, dispassion, means the absence of the cake's ability to control you. You're in control of you. If you want the cake, eat it. If the doctor says don't eat the cake and you still want to eat the cake, eat it. But if you don't want to eat the cake and that cake makes you eat it, That's the problem. That's, you're not in control. The cake is in control. So that's the opposite of vairagya. So vairagya then is, and here literally it says dispassion towards all sense objects. It says literally, it means towards all enjoyments in life. Dispassion towards all enjoyments in life does not mean living in a cave. Now people, you see that word vairagya or viraga, and in this tradition, so many people think, the image comes. Vairagya, yes, the sadhu sitting in the cave meditating. That's not vairagya. That's sitting in a cave and meditating. Vairagya means not to be controlled by the piece of cake. Vairagya means not to be swayed or controlled by any worldly enjoyment whatsoever. Okay, this is vairagya. How will you develop that vairagya? So dispassion towards all worldly enjoyments is one of our 20 values. How does one cultivate that value? Well, that's actually included in the next one. Janma, mrityu, jara, vyadhi, dukkha, doshanudarshanam. These long compounds are sometimes best read from right to left instead of left to right, at least for the beginning. So the final word in the long compound is anudarshanam. Anudarshana means seeing. Anudarshana means reflecting. Reflecting, considering, contemplating, all of those meanings. Reflecting on what? The anudarshana, reflecting on the dosha, the defect, the shortcoming, the problematic nature. The problematic nature of what? Dukkha, suffering. So dukkha, dosha, anudarshana, reflecting on the problem of suffering. Suffering due to what? Well, the first part of the compound. There is suffering due to janma. When you're born, not, I know mothers also suffer during birth, but here we're talking about you. Once you're born, you start suffering, right? The first thing we do after being born is not to laugh. The first thing we do is we cry. So our dukkha, worldly suffering, begins with janma, birth. It ends with mrityu, death, more suffering. In between janma and mrityu come what? Jara, old age, and vyadhi, illness. So janma, and they're like bookends. Janma and mrityu, birth and death, both of which entail considerable suffering. And in between these two bookends are what? Jara, aging, and vyadhi. What a miserable... It's a very depressing image of life, but one that we can't ignore. And one of the... We definitely don't want to be morose and always think, oh, I'm going to die and this is terrible. This is all, life is transient and all these pleasures are fleeting and everything is meaningless. And this kind of really depressive thinking is not healthy, it's not desirable, and it's certainly not one of our 20 values. What it says here is dukkha doshanudarshanam, reflecting on the problem of suffering due to birth, death, old age, and illness. That's literally what it says. But reflecting doesn't mean being immersed in depression. Reflecting means being objective. Being objective means what? Means whatever age we are now, we have a finite number of years before us. In those finite number of years, there's going to be a significant amount of difficulty, of suffering. How are we going to meet that suffering? That's anudarshana. It's not becoming depressed and morose and morbid. It really is being objective. Objective is a word that my guru loves to use for good reason. to be objective about our lives. To be objective means not to paint an overly rosy picture, nor to paint the opposite picture, that very dark, depressing picture, but to be objective. Objectively speaking, there will be many challenges and difficulties ahead in our life. Are we ready to deal with those difficulties? And here now the connection to the Indriyarteshu Vairagyam. By reflecting on the difficulties of life, by acknowledging objectively the shortcomings of worldly life, and specifically by recognizing that no matter what we do, we cannot escape jara, vyadhi, and mrityu. No matter what we do, we can't escape the suffering due to aging, due to illness, and due to death, which means we better come up with another solution. Right? What is the solution? The solution is not a worldly solution. Therefore, vairagyam, dispassion towards worldly pleasures, and dispassion, that's kind of like the negative side of it. Dispassion towards worldly pleasures means what? Focus on spiritual growth. These are two kinds of orientation to life which stand in contrast to each other. To the extent you are busily engaged in seeking happiness in life, to that extent you're ignoring spiritual growth. To the extent that you're focused on spiritual growth, to that extent necessarily you're not out in the world seeking happiness. So it's a matter of focus. It's a matter of priority. That would be the nice word to use. What is your priority? Is your priority on worldly enjoyments? Remember some months ago I was on that Starbucks kick? Just everything was Starbucks. So we'll use that one again. Worldly enjoyment means your number one priority is to stop at Starbucks on your way to work. Whatever it is. On the other hand, suppose you weren't so dependent on stopping at Starbucks every day, then your mind would be more free for something a little bit more important than Starbucks coffee. Many things more important than Starbucks coffee. That's vairagya. Okay. We'll continue. Asaktiranabhishvangaha Asaktiranabhish Putradhara grahadishu Putradhara Nityancha samachittatvam Nityancha sama Ishtanishtopapattishu Ishtanishtopapattishu Asaktihi. Absence of sakti, absence of attachment. Attachment, you've heard the definition we've used here before. When you say you're attached to someone or something, what does that mean? It obviously doesn't mean it in a literally sense. It's not literal sense. It's not like you're physically connected to someone or something. Attachment, and listen to this definition, it's very helpful. To look upon someone or something as essential to your well-being. That's attachment. Anything or anyone that you judge to be essential for your happiness and well-being, that is attachment. It's almost the same as saying dependence. And it definitely is not love. We had a discussion about love some time ago. We won't go back over all of that. But here, there's a difference with regard to your spouse or your family members, your children, your parents. There's a big difference between being loving them and being attached to them. Being attached means being emotionally dependent on them. Being emotionally dependent is not loving them. It's hanging on them, or worse, it's strangling them. Why is it strangling them? You want to get something out of them. This is a hard thing to talk about, but this is Bhagavad Gita class. We're supposed to talk about the hard things. Let's talk about a parent's love for a child. We all know what the ideal of that love is, what the pure parental love for a child, we know what that is. And every parent has that love. In addition to that love, almost all parents also have attachment. They have both. Love is there, also is attachment there. What is the attachment part? The attachment part is that the child has to do such and such and so for the parents to feel okay. We joked about this before, many of you have older kids, you can relate to this, when your high school senior says, I'm going to go to college and study art. And some parents will say, oh God, why do you want to study art? And it becomes a huge problem for the parent. Why? Think about it just for a moment. Why should it be such a problem for the parent? It's a huge problem for the parent. Suppose art is the one study that is truly going to make the child happy. Still, the parent doesn't want them to do so, because it's not the parent's idea of what their child should be doing. And let me give a tougher example, a more poignant example that sadly happens still far too often, and that is when not the 16-year-old or 17-year-old, but the 23-year-old, 24-year-old says, Mom, Dad, I'm going to marry him or I'm going to marry her. And parents say, what? No. And what follows, I'm saying this in a humorous way, but what happens in these families is anything but humorous. What happens in those families is horrible. The amount of hurt and suffering on both sides, for the parents and for the children. Why? The child has decided to marry someone who the parent doesn't approve of. Now, if the parent really wants the child to be happy, shouldn't the parent be happy that the child has found someone they love? Should be, but that's not always how it works. That is attachment. And that is just a huge problem, not just in the context of marriage, but in so many contexts. How you've heard, and I've heard so many times, I've had the parents come here and speak, Swamiji, my son or daughter wants to marry this person. What can I do? And what am I supposed to say? And what I attempt to do is open up some broader kind of understanding. And anyway, it's a long, complicated issue, and I think it would be inappropriate for me to talk extensively about this, maybe in satsang if you want to talk about this weekend. This is not the time and place for it. But what a great example of attachment. Sakti here is attachment. Asakti is the absence of attachment. And almost has the same meaning to unabhishwangaha. Abhishwangaha also means attachment, clinging. That's why I said before, it's not love, it's hanging on someone, it's strangling them. When the parents respond to the child, to the adult child's choice of study in college, or when they respond so negatively to a choice of spouse, isn't that like strangling? Strangling your own child, strangling your loved one. Why? Due to attachment. Here, the second term used to describe that attachment is abhishwangaha. Abhishwangaha, clinging holding on to. Holding on to what you want. Abhishwangaha, clinging to what you want. Clinging to what? It says putra, dara, grihadishu. Clinging on to putra, son or daughter, children. Clinging on to dara, wife or husband, spouse. Clinging on to griha, house, adi, etc. Clinging to any of these, holding on to them for the sake of your own contentment. That's not love, that is emotional dependence. Emotional dependence, I'm hesitant to use such strong metaphors. Emotional dependence means you're trying to, sorry to use a strong metaphor, you're trying to suck something out of the other person. Isn't that what emotional dependence is about? There's something in the other person you want. You want their affection. You want their love. You want their obedience. You want their regard. You want a pat on the back. Whatever it is, you want it, and you're going to somehow try to draw it out of the other person. That is emotional dependence. That is asaktihi. Here, asakti means absence of sakti. Asakti means sakti. Are you following me? Sakti means attachment. Asakti is a more common term for attachment. Here, asaktihi, absence of attachment, and also unabhishwangaha. Abhishwangaha, again, is clinging, emotional clinging, dependence. Unabhishwangaha, absence of this clinging dependence towards putra, children, dara, spouse, griha, house, adi, etc. would include your profession, would include any number of things. Then, nityam cha samachittatvam. Samachittatva, equanimity. Chitta, mind. Chittatva, the status of your mind, the condition of your mind. The condition of your mind being sama, the same. So a condition of the mind being undisturbed, samachittatvam. Undisturbed in what situations? Ishta, anishta, upapattishu. Upapatti means the occurrence of something. Things occur. In life, things happen. What happens in life? Ishta, desirable things happen in life, and anishta, undesirable things happen in life. When something desirable happens in life, what happens? Your emotions go up. When something undesirable happens in life, your emotions go down. Then what happens? Up. Then what happens? Down. Then what happens? Up, down, up, down. This is that roller coaster of life. I don't know about you, but I'm not very fond of these roller coasters and stuff. It's rough on the stomach. It's rough on the eyes. It's uncomfortable to go through these extreme ups and downs of life. So this samachittatvam means not to be so dramatically affected by all these natural ups and downs in life. Nityam, at all times, in all situations, to be relatively free from those extreme ups and downs in life. Do you know, when we are so affected by the ups and downs in life, what happens is our emotions get very stirred up. You know people like this, right? People who, in their life, always major dramatic events are happening. Some of those events are wonderful and great and ecstatic. Some of those events are terrible, they're tragic, they're disastrous. So therefore, this person is on this emotional roller coaster. Tell me, how can one live a life of spiritual growth when you're on an emotional roller coaster? Emotions are normal. We all have some ups and downs in life. That's not what we're talking about. what we're talking about are these dramatic shifts. Someone who one day they're elated, they're at the top of the world, next day they're so depressed, they're crying. There's this excess of drama in people's lives. We won't go on to the next verse, so let me talk about this just for a few minutes here at the end of our class. There seems to be some tendency in many lives for an extreme of drama, which means extreme highs and extreme lows. And I wonder if that isn't partially due to our entertainment, in particular movies. When you watch these typical dramatic movies, both Hollywood and Bollywood, they're kind of similar. You know, when they show a family, do they show a family just being together doing normal things? You know, so in the morning, you know, they have breakfast, and then dad goes off to work, mother cleans up the sink, kids go off to school, and then in the evening, kids come home, the kids do their homework, father comes home, they have dinner, they watch TV and they go to bed. Is that the plot of a movie? But normal life sort of resembles that, does it not? But what they show on the movie is something so extraordinary. Something, you know, some family members are on the top part of the emotional roller coaster, and some are on the bottom part of the emotional roller coaster, and is going back and forth. The family members are going through extreme emotional highs and lows. Why did they do that in a movie? It's entertaining. It captures your attention. But now here's a problem. Some psychologists have suggested, and how far this is true, I don't know, but they've suggested that some people become addicted to drama in their life. Just like you would get bored with a very ordinary movie, you want a movie with all of that, and you would say all that masala. All right. But then, if you like that masala in your movie, then some people want that same masala in their life. And they want the highs and lows in their life, because if they don't have some highs and lows in their life is so boring. And they feel like they're dead inside. They feel like nothing's happening. And this is not a common problem, but some people do have this problem, that they live in such a way where they cause extreme highs and lows to come into their lives. It's an emotional problem. The seeking out of an overly dramatic life, it's a problem. And perhaps everyone picks up a little bit of it from watching all the Hollywood and Bollywood stuff. So here, we want to, for the sake of sadhana, have life be somewhat on an even keel. If you're going on these emotional highs and lows, all of your attention will go into dealing with the intense emotions associated with whatever is happening. If we can manage to have a life which is more calm, then to that extent, we have more attention available for really very deep, profound spiritual pursuit. And that's the idea of this value. Samachittatvam, equanimity, nityam at all times, towards ishta, anishta, upapatti, towards the current, towards when things are going well, when things are not going well, it means to maintain a relatively even keel. We have just a little bit more to go on this particular topic. We'll finish in the next class. And there's also a beautiful, really nice metaphor I'll share. I thought we'd get to it today. We didn't quite get there. We'll get to it in the next class. By the way, these verses, we're taking some time going over them because these 20 qualities, virtues, are so important. This is the qualification. This is what we need to cultivate in our minds and hearts so that, what are we seeking? Brahma vidya. What will it take to be qualified to gain that Brahma Vidya. That's why we're spending this time. It's time well spent. Okay, a couple of quick announcements. Tomorrow, Sunday, we have satsang at 6:15. If you have questions, please come. If the weather is nice, we'll sit outside. Also, to remind you, 2 weeks from today, we're celebrating our 14th anniversary. Please plan on coming. We have a delightful program planned. Also, if you have friends or relatives or neighbors who might be interested, it's a wonderful time to bring them. Bring them along, and they'll enjoy the program. So it'll be 2 weeks from today. Library will be open after class, and we'll conclude with our prayers.